Mr. Durr, it's been a pleasure to spend a part of the afternoon with you.
Well, thank you, John. It's been a pleasure to spend the afternoon with you, and particularly looking at those long putts coming back after our long first putts, trying that straight course we were playing.
Yeah, the Thistledew course is a putting course here at Pinehurst that we had a duel on. It will be posted at Pinehurst Facebook page. That there was video shot, although I don't think that anybody made a one.
Didn't nobody make a one? No, no one. But it's almost like putting in the ocean.
Yes.
You know, is this going to be a big wave or a little wave?
I think that is well put. You were kind enough to bring me a copy of your book, My Place at the Table, published back in 2010. And the blurb on the flap in front says, some of the people you will read about are golfers Bobby Jones, Babe, Donald Ross, Sam Snead, Ben Hogan, Byron Nelson, Jack Nicklaus, President Eisenhower. You knew personally all of those people.
Yeah, I covered most of the golfers I covered. I knew President Eisenhower. I had known him when he was at Columbia, and then after he was named president and came to Augusta from time to time, I saw him. Had an interesting experience with him one day that we did our first television at Augusta. And on Monday afternoon, I always checked out with Cliff Roberts the next day to see how we were doing. And so that day, Tuesday, I was over at Cliff's office, and he said, where are your clubs? And I said, well, they're in my car. I'm getting ready to drive back to New Jersey, back to my home in Montclair. He said, well, you better go get your clubs, because the chief came in last night, and he said, get in touch with John Durr. I want him to play with me at 10 o'clock in the morning, because he had listened to the telecast of the TV telecast. And I said, I can't play, Cliff, I can't play today because I'm going back to New Jersey. We've been married for 12 years, and my wife and I live in New Jersey, had a wonderful relationship, except for 12 years, all we've got to show for it is four black cats, and now she's going to have a baby. We've just got confirmation that she's pregnant and we're going to have a baby, and I've got to go home. This is very exciting to me, and I can't stay and play golf with the president. So Cliff says, that's up to you, because he's the one that made the date, so you have to explain it to him. And he says, but he likes children, so he might understand. So I go get my clubs, and I go down, and I meet the president, and I said, I understand you want to play. And he said, well, I don't want to talk to you about some of the stuff I saw yesterday. So I said, Mr. President, I can play nine holes, but I'm going to have to leave after nine because I've got to start for New Jersey. Well, you know, you don't usually walk out on the President of the United States.
Or Mr. Roberts.
And Augusta National. And he said, that's quite all right. We'll pick up somebody at the turn. So I played the front nine and said goodbye to Mr. Eisenhower. And he went home. He had his ileitis operation that summer, was reelected president. Came back to Augusta that fall. And came back, and he went to play with Cliff, and Cliff said, well, the Durrs had a little girl. So the next day I got a letter from the Southern White House. That's the way they identified Augusta National, Southern White House. And he said, the coincidence, I heard on the first tee that you're going to have a child. And when I'm next back on the first tee, I hear that the child has been born and you have a little girl. But Cliff did not know her name. So in the next few days, you will be receiving from me a memento for her. And he said, not having her name, I was not able to have it engraved. But he said, I will rely on you to engrave the memento before you give it to her. And we got this beautiful little bas-relief picture of the Eisenhower and of the president. And on the reverse side, it said, in appreciation of our friendship. And then you turn it over, and there's the place to engrave. But you don't think I put her name on there, do you?
Oh, that is priceless. Obviously, from the early days on, Augusta National was a very special place. And President Eisenhower was a big part of that. Obviously, Mr. Jones and Mr. Roberts' vision there was second to none.
Oh, you're correct. Absolutely, John. It was second to none. And it was different. I mean, people talked about it being high hat and what have you, but there was a great feeling of friendliness that emanated from the top down. There was a great deal of friendliness. I played a lot of golf with Cliff. I mean, Cliff and I played quite often. And we played just the two of us, and it was fun. And I had tea with him in his – he lived in that corner room, and we had tea at 10 o'clock every morning. He would ask me to come up and have tea. So we became real good friends. And we played one day on the big course and got in, and Cliff said, John, you want to try the little course? You know, you're familiar with their little par three course, which is not little. I mean, it's pretty good par three. And I said, yeah, let's try that. So we moved over from the big course over to the little course, played it, and he and I were walking back to his quarters, and he said, well, John, he says, you played pretty well today, didn't you? And I said, well, Cliff, I had a good day for me. I had three bogeys, and three pars, and three birdies, so I came up with 27. He said, yeah, that's right. Well, you might want to remember that round, probably the last time you get to play here.
Now, it seems to me that if I was ever as fortunate as that, that after 18 on the big course, there might be a cocktail accompanying me over to the little course. Just a guess.
A guess. Well, that sometimes happens.
Well, on occasion?
On occasion.
On occasion.
But not that day, but another day. We did play after that. Another day we were playing, and we come down to 15. You know, I did the 15th tower 21 years. I covered every missed putt on the 15 at the green. So we leave the 15th, and I said to Cliff, I said, Cliff, I've been thinking, I'm getting a little long in the tooth, and I was thinking, you know, people ask me where I'm going to be buried or what have you, and I said, I'm thinking about being cremated, and I'd like to have my ashes dropped here at the lake at the 15th. I mean, this is where I spent 20 years. I mean, 1 week out of every year I was here. Well, Johnny, he says, you have to remember that Augusta National is a golf course, not a cemetery. And I said, oh, well, that's the end of that. Well, a couple of years later, Cliff died. He committed suicide, and he died, and I was not there, but I stopped by the office 2 years later and talked to Mr. Juswick, and I said, did Cliff go back to Colorado? Did they bury him back in Colorado? Because I wasn't here, and I wondered what they did. She said, oh, no. Said he was cremated. And she said, you'll find that his ashes are buried down at the 15th green on the lake. And I said, count me out.
He beat you to it. He beat you to it. Isn't that funny? I cannot wait to ask you about Princess Grace, Grace Kelly, who you knew.
Oh, I knew Princess Grace. She was a lovely girl. I knew her. She wasn't a lovely girl when I first met her, but she was a lovely girl. Her brother, Jack, was a sculler, as you know. He was the American sculling champion. And in 1948, the whole American team went over to Europe for the Olympics, to London, and we all went over on the SS America. So it was a very fine, it was the last time that the team went anywhere together. It was a great time. You got to know the basketball players and the track stars and the boxers, everybody. And I made an effort to get every American winner, the people who were going as winners, and do a little interview with them on board on the way over. And so I ran into, arranged to meet Jack Kelly, and I said, I would like to have you. And we set up a time like 10:40 at Tuesday. And he said, well, I'd be glad to come and do the interview. Said, can I bring my kid sister? She listens to you on the radio station in Philadelphia, and she likes to hear you. She's asked if she could meet you. And I said, oh, by all means. I mean, I don't know who his kid sister is, but he brings her over, and here comes this little knock-kneed kid with short dress on, little socks, and he introduces me to his sister Grace. And so that was how I met Grace Kelly in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. Well, we became pretty good friends after that. I did a nice interview with Jack, but I didn't pay much attention to her until she got a little older, but she was young at that time. But then back in New York, so when she won her Oscar for High Noon, they asked me to be the MC at her party when the Poor Richard Almanac was going to have a party for her. But I had a commitment to Pabst Blue Ribbon, and I could not get off. It was on a Friday night, and I couldn't go down. But Grace came up with some people from New York to New York, and they were going to tell me that they would have a helicopter fly me from the CBS studios down to Philadelphia. I could get there and do this late-night interview with or MC of Kelly's party. Well, I said, that's too, we can't do that. But the people who had come up with her, they left, and we were having lunch at Toots Shores. You've been to Toots many times. And we were sitting at Toots' place, and everybody from her group left. Just she and I were left. She said, well, John, we've run out of friends, and everybody's left. And I have missed the train to Philadelphia. I'm going to have another hour. What are we going to do? And I said, well, we can have coffee and go to the bathroom and have coffee and go to the bathroom, and then it'll be time to catch the train to Philadelphia. So we sat there until through the dinner hour had gone. And the next day, Dorothy Kilgallen, remember Dorothy Kilgallen? Well, she was a columnist for the New York Journal American, gossip columnist, and she had an item in her column which said, could it have been sports that John Durr and Grace Kelly were discussing at Toots Shores yesterday while holding hands under the table? So as soon as that paper hit the newsroom and CBS, they came rushing around and said, oh, you're in the gossip column. So you had Grace Kelly holding hands under the table. I said, no, somebody told Kilgallen, because she wasn't there, but somebody told her, and she got it all wrong, because we were not holding hands. I was feeling her knee.
And who could blame you? And who could blame you? During the break, I said, did you know Bing Crosby? And a big smile came over your face. And I said, save it for the listeners. Tell me about Bing Crosby.
Well, I did Bing's tournament back in the day, before television. And Bing had asked in New York that I be sent out to do it. So it was a sustaining show. And Bing and I did the first year, actually, he was on the air with me. We did the commentary together. But I stayed at his home. And He lived, you know, right there at Pebble, and he had a nice home. And one year we had Bob and Dolores Hope were house guests. Bing had a little ingenue from Hollywood there at that time. His wife had died, and he was playing the field. So he came back, and he said, John, I'm going to have to go over to the inn there at Pebble, and start to Calcutta. I said, Bob and I have to welcome the people. I said, but you don't have to go. You can stay here, because we'll only be gone 20 minutes. You can stay here, and we'll come by and pick up you and the girls and go downtown and eat. And Hope says, well, I'll be damned if that's so. I ain't leaving him here with Dolores. So I had to go out and get in Bing's big Packard. He drove, and I got in the middle, and Hope on the outside. So I said, we're on our way to the Calcutta.
It's hard to believe that what they started as fun has turned into the tournament that it's turned into.
Yeah.
I mean,
it was an invitational that Bing would put up the money and everything, but he was, he was a very good friend. We spent a lot of time together. He wrote to me a lot. I had a letter from a 2-page typewritten letter about 2 weeks before he died. You know, he died in Spain, died at the golf course in Spain. But he had just run into a difficulty with the PGA, which wanted to make the list of players. You see, the Crosby was an invitational. He had his friends play, and he would bring up his movie actor friends to play with them. So he wanted to control who was going to play if it was his tournament. But the PGA didn't like that. They had too many people that didn't have a place to play that week, and they wanted to play. So they said they want to expand it to where we have 140 players. Well, Bing couldn't handle 140 players. So it was he wrote me some very unpleasant things about what was going to happen. And he took the tournament off. You know, he left the tournament. They moved it to Winston-Salem. Remember that?
Sure.
But he was very unhappy that he could not invite just the people he wanted. Well, he wanted people like Dutch Harrison and people that were not necessarily named people, but they were friends of his. And, of course, all of the Hollywood crowd was there. It was fun at that time. And staying at Bing's house, we had a lot of fun.
When you look back at the golfers from that era.
Oh, wonderful.
Hogan and Snead and people that you called friends,
like Jerry Barber, Little Jerry, you know, and that group. And it was. I saw Hogan win his first tournament, which he won right 100 yards from where we are standing right now. He won his North and South in 1940, which was the first individual tournament that Hogan won on the tour. And he won it because he had a new driver that he had received. Sarazen had a driver that let him had Drew drivers made and gave one to Hogan. And Hogan quit hooking when he got Sarazen's driver, and he won the tournament here. And he played the last four holes in four threes. That tells you how he finished on the thing. But he beat Snead by 2 shots and won the North-South, and that was his first victory. I was with him for most of his victories. I was with him at Carnoustie. I walked every way, step of the way with him at Carnoustie when he won the Open there. And I went to 2 practice rounds with him, which is interesting. And he had told me one time when we were in Texas, he said he'd rather be horsewhipped than to play in a pro-am because you spend all of your time looking for somebody's ball. So every day at Carnoustie, he would say, "John, they have rental clubs at the clubhouse. Would you like to join me?" And I said, "Oh no, Bing, I'd just rather walk along and ask you questions," because I didn't want him to feel like he'd been horsewhipped again. So I walked with him for the practice rounds and for the tournament itself. And when we got to the 16th hole, which is a par 3, 255 yards. That he had bogeyed the first 2 days. On the last round, he hit the green, the front part of the green. And he knew that he had a 2-stroke lead at that point. And he came over to me on the side of the tee, and he said, "John, go in and get ready for your broadcast. This tournament is over."
Wow.
John, can you imagine somebody saying that to you on the 16th tee at Carnoustie during the British Open? I mean, of all things. Well, he knew what lead he had, so I had been able to give him the information about what the others were doing, and he knew he had a couple of strokes on everybody because he would ask me to come in. The police were formed a cordon around him so that they didn't have roping at that time. And so he'd called and wanted to know about this, and I had given him that. And after he got on the green at 16, he knew that he could play the last 2 holes all right, and he did birdie the last hole and won by 4 strokes.
Incredible. Incredible. What kind of a person was he?
Well, I loved him. I, of course, I grew up with Snead, and Sam and I were very, very close friends. I spent a lot of time with Sam, played with him, and, I enjoyed Sam. But Hogan was a different type person. You got a different, but very loyal to you. He knew that I was a close friend of Snead's, and he respected the fact that I was Snead's friend. But when you get to know him, people thought he was rather dour. You know, we were rained out one day at Fort Worth, and Ben kept the locker room absolutely livid with jokes, most of which were off color. And
really?
Everybody was surprised to hear Hogan telling dirty jokes in the locker room. But he was a great, great man.
I know that you've spent a lot of time with Jim Dotson, who was with us here.
Well, I'd rather spend time with his wife. I like she's much better than I am. As you'll see in my book, right off the bat, he says the first thing he says, and he wrote in the book, he said, "John Durr is madly in love with my wife, and I think she feels the same way about him." But Jim's a great guy. I knew his father when I was at the Greensboro Daily News years ago. His father was in the advertising business, and this was long before Jim was born. Jim's just a young kid. I think he's probably
60.
Around 60. Well, that's, I was 35 years old before he was even thought of.
95 years old. And still out there rolling it around on the putting green with me. That is.
We had fun, though, John.
We did have fun. When people pick up your books, what I like about this is, yes, it's about golf, but it also crosses over. Albert Einstein,
Mahatma Gandhi, Eisenhower. I had a lot with Eisenhower. And Billy Graham, I had a friendship with Billy Graham. Billy Graham I ran into in Jamaica one time, and we were at the men's room when I first recognized him, but I quickly got out of there and talked to him when we got outside. And he said, "Are you down here on vacation or are you working?" I said, "I'm down here more or less on vacation, but I run a series of tournaments here. I'm surprised that you would recognize that." He says, "Well, I don't preach all day on Sunday, you know. I watch I watch a lot of golf tournaments, so I know who you are.
You've mentioned Babe Ruth as well.
Yeah.
Did you know the Babe?
Oh, very, very well.
What'd you call him?
Well, I called him
Did
Babe.
Did you call him George or
No,
or
I called him Babe. He used to come down to CBS to be a guest on Red Barber's show. And, of course, Red knew him, and he knew Red, and I had not known him. But he would come down, and Red would tell me to go down, meet the cab, pay the cab, bring him up to the green room, and you sit and talk with him until the time for the show. Well, John, this would give me sometimes 15 or 20 minutes to sit and talk, just to two of us to talk to Babe Ruth. Now, where would you have an opportunity to sit down and talk with Babe Ruth, except he's getting ready to go on Barber's show? So we became very good friends. And in the course of that, Edward R. Murrow realized that he had hired me at CBS, that I knew Babe. And I'm in London one day. I had just spoken at the Anglo-English Press Club in Paris. And I got a phone call from CBS that Mr. Murrow wanted to talk with me. So I went down to the CBS office in Paris and had them connect me to Murrow. And he said, "I got bad news for you. Babe Ruth died today." And I said, "Oh, I'm terribly sorry to hear that. I knew that he was not in good health, but it's shocking when you have somebody that you like that much to do." And I said, "I'm sorry, Ed. I'm really sorry." He said, "Well, why I called you is I want you to do his obituary." And I said, "Well, I'm in Paris. I don't have any records. I can't even tell you how old he was. I don't know how many home runs he hit." He said, "We don't need how many home runs. I can go to the record book and find his home runs, and we can go and find out when he was born and can figure out how old he is." But he said, "I've heard you say that when you grew up down in North Carolina, you used to, every morning, your dad would get the Charlotte Observer and you'd rush to the sports page to see if Babe Ruth had had a home run." I said, "Yes, that's correct. He was my hero when I was in high school. In that reading and never having thought I would have a chance to meet him or to see him, but he was my hero." And as it turned out, when I in his later life and mine, we became friends. So I was pleased. So Murrow said, "What I want you to tell is how was it to know your hero face to face before you died?" That's what I told in my obituary to Babe Ruth.
You know, it seems to me that clearly, there are exceptions to this rule, but in modern times, there are less people who wear as many hats as you wore throughout your career as a writer, a radio broadcaster, a television broadcaster.
Maybe that's why I'm bald-headed.
Maybe. But was there one that stood out to you over the others, one that you were more passionate about?
Well, I was a writer to start with. I did high school work at the Gastonia Gazette as a high school reporter for the Gazette. So I was a writer at that time. I had a very good editor who would have me bring my stories into his office, and he actually had a blue pencil, and he would read the story and show me what I was doing wrong. So he taught my journalism was there. And the newspaper offered me a job if I wanted to work there after I graduated from high school. I did not have any money to go to college, so I had to work. And I took the job there, and it didn't pay a whole lot. I started at $6 a week, which is comes out to about one payday a week, but you get $6 that day. But I hung around there, but I wanted to write, so I could not afford to go to school, so I went to Belmont Abbey. And asked the coach down there was a man named Humpy Wheeler, whose son later ran the racetrack in Charlotte. Well, Humpy had gone to school at Illinois and had become an All-American, and he coached the football team at Belmont Abbey, the Red Crusaders, and I had covered them when I was a sports editor there. And so I said to Humpy, "I need an education. I have no way of getting an education. You need a public relations. You've got a great school, but you're not getting any publicity. You need a PR guy. I'll be glad to be your PR guy if you will teach me English and composition." So he took me down to see the provost, took me down to see Father Cuthbert, who was the head of the abbey. And he said, "Oh, yes, sir, that would be great. We do need a PR guy. He has connections with Charlotte and Greensboro and Raleigh and Asheville, and these are places we want to get players in from and students in from. So let's do something. Get in for right away. Get in touch with Father Davis and bring him up and let him teach him." So I had journalism teaching by the head of the Catholic University College, who was retired to Belmont Abbey. And so two nights a week when I'd go to the school to do my PR work, I would have a lesson in how to compose a letter and what have you. So it was direct composition. People said, well, where did you go to school? I said, well, I studied at Belmont Abbey. Well, how did you make out? And I said, I was the valedictorian. I was the only one in my class.
Absolutely. I mean, that is funny. Well, is there anyone looking back? I mean, Joe DiMaggio, all of Marilyn Monroe. I'm assuming if you met DiMaggio, you met Marilyn Monroe.
Oh, yeah.
Was that?
Oh,
and I want, yeah. You know what?
Oh, no,
forget the rest of the question.
Don't go there. Joe sat with me probably 14 times on the tower because he said, I want to sit up there with you because almost nobody comes by and asks for an interview when you're 20 feet up in the air. Have you found that to be true, John?
That does seem to be true, absolutely.
So anyway, when Joe was coming, and he had friends with the network, and he would come to the whatever tournaments we were doing. I had him in Miami and around. Joe would come up and sit on the tower with me for the afternoon. Well, you, as you know, in doing the broadcast, you have certain times that you can talk. And so Joe and I talked a lot. But he came to Pinehurst here. He came and visited me. You're here in Pinehurst. He came down and we played. And actually, we went on to course number 3 one day, and he said, if I were to build a home away from San Francisco, which is where he grew up, you know, he said, I would want my home right here on this 9th fairway at number 3 course at Pinehurst. Well, so he loved it.
Why did you choose Pinehurst? Obviously, doing what you did, you could work and live anywhere in the country. Why did you settle in Pinehurst?
I don't know. Sometimes I wonder why I settled in Pinehurst. I was living in New York. Traffic got a little heavy.
Yes.
But I always wanted to be back. I was born in North Carolina, and I had grown up here. I went to school with Bill Friday and I were in school together from the time we were. Actually, I said we were together from diapers to death, which Bill and I were. I did quite an obituary when he died a few weeks ago, months ago. But he was my dearest friend in school.
The book is My Place at the Table. It's one of many. The website is just johndursports.com.
It's www.johndursports.com.
Yes.
www.johndursports.com, and my daughter handles all the book sales and so forth. But I tell you, John, if I may sell just a minute, it makes a great gift for a member guest tournament or a member tournament. Greenbrier bought 200 of them for the Greenbrier Festival last year, and I autographed them for it. But it's the thing about buying something for a member guest tournament is you don't have to worry about what color and what size. One
right.
Book fits all. And she has a very good price on the thing, and we'll send it to you. So if you will contact her at johndursports.com, she'll be glad to finish it up. Thank you.
You just did some sales. I do a tournament here in November every year, and I don't know that all the people that come to my tournament can actually read. But when they come this year, they'll get a copy of your book. It is such a pleasure to get to spend
some
time.
I'm sorry to have taken up so much of your time.
No, this has been fantastic.
Well, I know your friend Matt up at the
right
in the thing, and he has been very kind to me, and he talks about the book, and he tells what my web page is, and the first order I got after Matt talked came from Belgium, I think.
Really?
Yeah.
That's fantastic. I don't think that my sphere of influence reaches all the way to Belgium.
Well, I go out to the middle of the Atlantic.
Well, there you go. That's John Durr, ladies and gentlemen. JohnDurrSports.com, D-E-R-R. What a great pleasure. Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Can we do this again next year?
Absolutely. Well, I'm going to go to break right now. I'm going to get your... I'm going to get your phone number. I want to have you on before next year.
Thank you very much, John.
Thank you.